Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and today I'm here with Kent Blancett. Kent is the Langston Hughes Associate Professor of Indigenous Studies and History at the University of Kansas. He is of Cherokee, Creek, Choctaw, Shawnee, and Potawatomi background. And his new book, or his book from 2018, I guess I should say, not that new anymore, but is A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement. And that was published by Yale University Press in 2018, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Kent, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, would you kind of lay out your book for our listeners?
Yeah, no, I guess how I got into the story is kind of just as intriguing. And, you know, it really started out as getting involved in Native history. A lot of Native history as I was coming up was being written in the 19th century. So most people were kind of familiar with the Indian Wars and, you know, volumes have been written on Sitting Bull and Crazy Horse. And, you know, I realized kind of as a young Native scholar, not a lot had been done on, you know, post 1945 or more specifically 1960s history. And I kind of got involved in activism when I was an undergrad and was involved in the repatriation movement at Missouri. So I kind of had a inside view of Red Power activism, having worked with the American Indian Movement and other Native organizations on a national basis. So I kind of was looking for this topic in grad school. And I took a biography course that Frank Sazza taught, and he pretty much just said, you know, go around the room, and is there somebody that's kind of in the back of your mind that you've always wanted to know more about? And for me, it was an instant. It was Richard Oakes automatically. And part of that reasoning was that there was really only two books that had been written, Troy Johnson's The Occupation of Alcatraz, and then later also within the fairly shortly after that publication was Robert Warrior and Paul Chad Smith's book, Like a Hurricane, which was kind of going in an overview manner of the entire Indian movement from NIYC to Alcatraz to then the American Indian Movement. And the wild thing was that in the literature, Richard Oakes was just kind of a blip in the map. We have, you know, the portrait of him being one of the key and pivotal leaders of Alcatraz. And then literally after he leaves Alcatraz, his story just ends until his, what that point was his murder, which every account gave a different version of his death. So it was like, there was all this inconsistent information. There was very little information about him in his bio before he came to San Francisco. Most people knew he was an iron worker, but they didn't know much else other than, hey, he's Mohawk. He worked in high steel in New York. And that's about it. He was charismatic. He was handsome. He was kind of the brains behind a lot of the movement. But, you know, it's one of those things where I was like, you know, we need that narrative. We need to know what happened. And I think it was a big scratch of the head for Indian country, too, that to say that we needed something definitive on Oakes. And Oakes really pointed kind of a different vein of the movement. He wasn't like Dennis Banks or Russell Means or, you know, Clyde and Vernon Belcourt. The movement, which was Indians of all tribes, what I began to realize with my research, was just as prolific and widespread as AIM. And it was really a West Coast movement that was uniting activism from Fort Lawton in Seattle to Pitt River in Northern California to that tiny island in the Bay. And it changed everything overnight. It launched hundreds of occupations thus afterwards, and it really set the course for what would then be called the self-determination movement. So yeah, it wasn't as though I was like, you know, should I not write this book? It was, I have to write this book. And it was one of those things too, that, you know, I wasn't really at first writing this to not only fill kind of a gap in the historiographic record, but it was also largely this story that needed to be told to get justice for Richard Oakes in his life. More importantly, the person who would eventually assassinate him. So, and to shed light on that story a lot more too.
Yeah. Well, so for those For those of our listeners who, I think most of our listeners have probably heard of Alcatraz and the occupation, but they might not know a whole lot about the details. Can you, you know, just kind of briefly lay out, you know, how Richard Oakes leads this movement that really begins to change, you know, not only Native history, but American history?
Great. Yeah, no. At this point in time, Richard, when he gets to San Francisco is embroiled in what becomes kind of the Third World Liberation Movement. And part of this was is that, you know, courses at Berkeley and at San Francisco State, students began to realize that their classrooms didn't resemble the street. It didn't resemble their reality, which was a new multicultural, diverse world. You know, and this is in the context of Vietnam. This is the context of anti-war movement, you know, countercultural movements that are, you know, kind of really going full blown in the Bay Area to the Black Panther Party in Oakland. So you really have this revolutionary center in San Francisco. And of course, the students began to say, you know what, we need ethnic studies. We really want an education that resembles what our world is like. And so they began to walk out of the classrooms. As my students love to hear, faculty joined them in these protests and walked out. And they forced the university to actually create some of the first ethnic studies programs in the country in 1969. And Richard Oakes was one of the first to be the coordinator of Native Studies. So in many ways, Alcatraz has this very intellectual root as a foundation of Indigenous studies and an academic discipline. It also was something that came about through you know, a need to be able to showcase what was happening in Indian country in general during this time period. Some of these had to do with federal policies like the Termination Act, which was terminating tribes. Over 109 Native nations had their federal tribe status absolutely eradicated from 1953 to 1970. Out of that, you know, the federal government through the BIA was running a program called Relocation that its, you know, architect was, you know, Dillon Meyer, who was the head of the War Relocation Authority, who interned Japanese Americans, was now interning Indians in cities. So this was the design, in other words, this kind of revitalization of assimilation and acculturationist agendas towards Indian country. And Alcatraz was that stand, change that tide, to stand up and to resist, but also educate a greater populace in the world about what is Indigenous rights. And in many cases, I don't know that the students realized the ramifications of this movement was going to have. But the Indian Center would burn down in October of 1969, which was kind of the center of what was built in San Francisco, which was an Indian city, as I kind of describe in the book. In other words, a lot of other historians fail to kind of look at the environment. And they fail to look at the city, ironically, of where these movements are born out of, to see that, you know, this wasn't just something that was born out of the fog of San Francisco. There was resistance movements going on, you know, for centuries, even before Richard wound up in San Francisco. And there was this very kind of interconnected network of resistance that was going on in this Indian city, and some key institutions. And one of those being the Indian Center burns down. And there was this kind of call for, we need to create a new kind of center, a new kind of space for organizing in the Bay Area. And of course, Alcatraz had been abandoned since 1963. The Lakota had taken it over. Russell Means and others had, along with Frank McKenzie, another Lakotas, used the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868 and 1964, and they took over the island for about an hour before they were kicked off. Well, one of the people that did the legal research for that was Belva Cottier, and Richard hires her to be kind of the community liaison with Native American Studies, and she begins telling the students about this 1964 takeover. And the students realize, yeah, this could be our time. This could be our time to actually make a stand and a cause. And, you know, and it could have been nothing. The day of the first takeover, which there was three attempts, occurred in November of 1969, November 9th. And they gathered by the docks, and they're reading a proclamation, which they wrote, and it was street theater. They were kind of pulling from Berkeley and what was going on in the streets. And they're like, hey, Alcatraz is this great metaphor for Indian country. There's no running water. There's no electricity. There's no employment. There's no mineral resources. I mean, it's a prison, for God's sakes. I mean, this is like the perfect metaphor for explaining the paternalism of the United States and colonization that's occurred towards our people. So literally they read this proclamation that has all that outlined in it, and this kind of reversal of colonization that they're creating. The problem was there was no boat. So literally they go and they find this guy who's like a skipper of like this, you know, massive pirate ship. Richard jumps off. He swims to the island. He's taken off, you know, very quickly thereafter. And then, of course, they go back in the night. They secure it again. And these are all scouting missions. And then D-Day occurs on November 20th, 1969. And they will hold the island for a period of 19 months. And in that time period, they'll capture world attention. Through newspapers, through television, and they'll begin to change the dialogue of Indian resistance in America forever.
Yeah. Also, you know, one of the, to build on something you were just saying, you know, one of the things that is most striking in your book is the need to look at Native history from an urban perspective, that, you know, the kind of narrative is all about the reservation and these very rural places, but that's not the reality, especially after termination begins for a huge number of Native people. And that very much includes Richard Oakes, who is Mohawk, but he has his own sort of urban background that's incredibly fascinating and is something that I think not very many people know about the Mohawk. So what is his kind of urban story and how does he end up in San Francisco, you know, this New Yorker, how does he end up in San Francisco anyway?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. You know, and it was really intriguing. I kind of got to the bottom of a lot of his early years by interviewing his brother at Akwesasne on the reservation. And, you know, it was really a big part of trying to figure out those early years of his life. But his father was at least serving in World War II during D-Day, and his family members, a lot of them were Mohawk code talkers for the D-Day invasion, which a lot of people don't realize. That Mohawks were making that kind of contribution. We mostly think of the Navajo code talkers. But his family not only had a connection to World War II, but his dad and his mom split up after the war. And he was at a very young age. He had another brother, Leonard, who was his younger brother. And they grew up in Brooklyn. His mom would eventually get him out of an orphanage. And she works two different jobs to be able to kind of support her kids. And they go to public school in Brooklyn. But they're also part of this Mohawk community that's really entrenched in Brooklyn. And this came about from Mohawks taking a commanding lead in working in the iron labor industry and building those skyscrapers of New York City, from Rockefeller Center to Chrysler Building, you know, the bridges, Verrazano Bridge. All that was, you know, constructed by Mohawk iron workers and ingenuity. And when we look at that city, what's fascinating to me is we don't see indigenous ingenuity. But it's there. It's in the very fabric and background and skeleton of that city, and every rivet that was basically thrown in. And so he gets involved in working in ironwork in this very centralized, you know, Mohawk city in Brooklyn around Slope Park and Gowanus districts. And then, of course, after that, he's making frequent trips back to the reservation. He's being politicized consistently as the Haudenosaunee are fighting against Kinzawa Dam. They're fighting against the St. Lawrence Seaway Project, which is taking up tons of their land, you know, for this massive development projects that are meant to, you know, back the military industrial complex of America. And out of this, he's getting a very intense education. And the city, it was seen by at least the Bureau of Indian Affairs as something that was supposed to rip our tribalism away from us. And in many ways, the city functioned as a way to preserve our nationalism and enhance our nationalism in other cases. And we can really see this in the life of Richard Oakes, just in that presence of that Mohawk nationalism that comes about through his life, that he never forgets who he is. In the midst of living in Brooklyn, New York. In fact, it becomes heightened for him. And then he moves to San Francisco, and his move to San Francisco is really kind of conspicuous. I mean, he has a falling out with his dad at the age of 16. They don't speak thereafter. He kind of kicks him out of the house. But he continues on with iron work. He gets involved with gangs. He's actually sent to prison for a time for stealing a meat truck Syracuse and taking it down to Onondaga Reservation and handing out meat to people. And he's caught red-handed in the back of the truck. So he's like serving in all these different institutions of incarceration, institutions that are meant to also, you know, be reawakening for our economy and build us into the middle class. I mean, all these different kinds of places that he's really worldly, at least in his indigenous point of view. And out of this, he goes to San Francisco. But what gets him there is he's married at one point. And the marriage just comes to a halt. He has a kid in this marriage, and her father is white and is a sheriff. And basically, with Richard's criminal background, it was told to me that, you know, he was never going to allow Richard to be a husband nor a father to the kid. And he was threatened. So not being able to be a dad, I think it destroyed him. Having his own separation from his own father. So he decided to change it up. And ironically, when he goes to San Francisco, the first job he gets is a truck driver. So it's like this kind of irony, like I got arrested for it. Hey, why not be a truck driver, right? So he lives at that for a very short time before becoming a bartender. And then when he's a bartender at Warren's Slaughterhouse Bar, which is the Indian bar in the city, that's when everything changes for Richard.
Well, I mean, and you know, you talk about him working at the Indian bar. Like, what is the sort of the urban culture of a place like San Francisco or Seattle, which you also talk about quite a bit? And who's coming here, and how do all of these different people from different tribes coming here? How does that sort of either reinforce or change their identity and helps build to what you and others call the Red Power movement?
Yeah. No, I was intrigued by this position. And part of it was like, no one's really defined what Red Power is. I mean, in a lot of the literature, we kind of talk around it a lot. And I really wanted to do something that was more definitive in the book. And where I saw the definitive was calling out what is Native nationalism and how Native nationalism doesn't really go away. And this would be like tribes working on their own bequest. Much like the Haudenosaunee against the St. Lawrence Seaway Project, or say the Black Hills Council to reclaim the Black Hills in the 1920s and 1930s, to the Northwest Indian Federation that was looking for fishing rights. And what I began to see is Red Power is very different because it becomes a national movement. But in that nationalism, there's a phenomenon that happens called intertribalism, which is rooted in urban discourses of the Indian cities. And what I really strove to do in trying to write this book that would have the histories of three Indian cities in it was to showcase something completely different from what a lot of my colleagues had done, which is, you know, typically urban Indian history is written from a standpoint of we're going to look at Chicago and only Chicago, from the 1920s to the 1940s, or we're going to look at only LA from this period. But what it does is it places Indian history in a vacuum. And what I really wanted to show was just how national and networked Native peoples were and are in this time period by doing something that involves the histories of three cities that Richard Oakes is inherently involved in, and that we don't lose our Indianness, but it becomes enhanced, and it becomes enhanced in a way that becomes a politic, a coalition politic, which is another central facet of the Red Power movement, right? Going from Native nationalism into coalition politic and intertribalism, where we're not losing our tribalism. It's becoming enhanced in our interactions with other Native peoples from other Native nations. So in that capacity, I was able to kind of narrow it down to new definitions and strategies for trying to understand what's happening in this political shift between the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. In Indian country. And the Indian city really is a vast part of that. And I think a lot of previous literature had always put up a dichotomous position of a binary that I was really trying to argue against, that binary of res versus urban, is to showcase that really there's a migratory sense to our urban experience in which a lot of Native peoples were also going back to the res as much as, you know, going to the cities, and that the cities became almost like a suburb for us in many ways. It became a way of grounding our economies, but those economies would always be taken back to Akwesasne by iron workers. It would always be taken back in Seattle from people that would be working in the canneries in Seattle. They would take it back to Puyallup or Nisqually to reinvest. And so Out of this, we can then see the cities operating in this kind of labor movement as well, which is, I think, really kind of fascinating to kind of explore and flesh out. But these were kind of central facets to the things I really wanted to explore. And Richard was the perfect way to do it. Biography was a way for me to be able to kind of blend these stories together, because there was readers that would tell me, well, you need to just take out the cities. You need to take out the urban history out of the book entirely and make it just a biography. And I'm like, no, because they need to be intersecting, and we can't lose the person and the reality of that, because most people don't, there's very few biographies that are written by Native peoples, about Native peoples. So that was another thing I was trying to do here, and using space and using place and a person's interaction with that space and place in complicated ways. So
yeah, so well, that's incredibly fascinating. So after, you know, Oakes leads the Alcatraz movement, he leaves, and then, you know, the movement stays around for a while longer. And this is what he's most known for. But can you talk about what happens, you know, or how he builds on Alcatraz to lead a series of other movements that really push this Red Power movement forward?
Oh, yeah. No, I love this question. You know, because it really gets to the second half of Richard's story and why Richard should be remembered even more so. And part of this was that he would give one of his most famous quotes, which was, "Alcatraz is not an island, it's an idea." And part of this was that it was this liberation theology that they were preaching in the takeover of Alcatraz. But it was, as I say, the mechanics were worked out in that takeover. The ability to then put it on a bus and transport it to Indian country and reapply those techniques of Alcatraz as strategies for liberation, that's the true vision. That's the true kind of brilliance of Richard in this time period, because he takes it not only to Fort Lawton and reproduces it in the Fort Lawton takeovers, which is successful, in which they get a military base in the middle of Seattle. And it's still today the Daybreak Star Indian Center, too. Then really focusing in on Pitt River Nation, in which they had 3.5 million acres of land. They were going against corporations like PG&E Corporation, which has been in the news as of late with the fires. In addition to, you know, they were in the news with the Erin Brockovich story. I mean, you can only imagine how they were treating her in the sense of like her just trying to find justice for the poisoning that many residents had to endure at the hands of PG&E, let alone much earlier than Erin Brockovich was Richard Oakes. And Oakes was working with Pitt River to reclaim that 3.5 million acres of land that they'd never ceded to the federal government. There was no treaty that was ever ratified by the Senate, and the Indian Claims Commission attempted to buy it out for 47 cents an acre, which was an insult. And Pitt River just said no. And yet during this time, all these corporations, Kimberly-Clark, PG&E, they've been pulling resources from their land without compensation. And so they used that kind of idea of like, well, we're going to start taking over PG&E campground lands. And we want to get arrested too. Please arrest us. Please charge us with trespass. Because if you charge us with trespass, you got to prove in a court of law that you have original title to the land. And they knew automatically they did not. And this would set a legal precedent. So it was more than just about the practice or the theater at that point. It was that this theater had real world implications to make positive change in Indian country. And they were getting good results. And apparently when Richard goes to serve a citizen's arrest on the head of PG&E Corporation in San Francisco, he's attacked in Warren's bar. He's hospitalized. He has to teach himself to talk again, to walk again. And you know what? He doesn't quit. I mean, right when he gets out of the hospital, he goes to an anti-war movement rally. And he's bringing in this coalition of brown berets, Black Panthers, you know, countercultural, you know, hippies like the Diggers and, you know, Wavy Gravy that, you know, had just, you know, cooked for thousands of people at Woodstock are now helping out at Pitt River. And so out of this, you know, he's bringing these people together in order to create positive change, but also a change that resembles an idea of what would become, you know, kind of a global understanding of indigenous rights and the indigenous rights movement. And then, of course, by 1972, he's assassinated. He's had several attempts on his life even in between that, which was important for me to point out. And this was a really difficult story to tell. A lot of people ask me, why did it take you so long to write it? I'm like, well, it was not easy to write about, for emotionally speaking. But it was not easy to write about because there's a lot of people that were uncomfortable talking about it due to the lasting implications of his death and the people that were involved in his death, which I think my hope is that I, you know, was able to uncover some new evidence about the case, which partly came through getting his FBI file, which I don't know that many people have ever seen or looked at. I was able to get it right before 9/11. So I'd had it for years. Mueller was actually the director at that time, which was kind of fascinating. But the file had in it interviews that did not appear in the original transcripts, which I found fascinating. Like, why was it the FBI, who was called in on a civil rights violation over Richard Oakes' death, why was it that they were interviewing people that weren't testifying in the trial? So this would have been new information for a prosecutor. The prosecutor was also a guy that was like fresh out of law school. He had no reason prosecuting Michael Oliver Morgan, who was the guy who shoots Richard Oakes. And much like a Byron De La Beckwith kind of case, you know, and Medgar Evers is kind of how this guy is. You know, and he it even asked cops, like, how do I get off free for killing this guy? I mean, he had two prior tips on Richard Oakes' life even before this. So there was many people that were implicated in this, going from the corporation or PG&E Corporation, who controlled the campground, that I find out later, who paid the paychecks of Michael Oliver Morgan, in the sense of the YMCA day camp. So, you know, there's these really intricate layers to the point where when you really look at the forensics of it, when Richard Oakes is shot, the bullet goes apparently through his heart. He's Morgan says that Richard's behind a tree or a redwood and he jumps out and threatens him with a knife and he pulls a gun. And in self-defense, he has to kill Richard Oakes, even though he probably could have turned around and ran away from Richard, because Richard, remember, had paralysis on half his body. So he probably wouldn't have been able to necessarily have caught Michael Morgan. But, you know, lo and behold, what we have is when we look at the forensics report and the coroner's report, it shows that the wound on his chest is large. It's enlarged. And there's this tiny wound on his back. In other words, he's shot with a 9mm, a welder 9mm at that, which was a German Luger. So there's this other implication of, you know, what ties does Michael Oliver Morgan then have to sympathies with the Nazi party or with Nazi Germany and having this gun or fascinations thereof? Not necessarily one of the two can meet, but it does make a strong case here. And then, of course, the wound with a 9mm, as we know, bullets shroom out. So in the two previous incidents that Richard Oakes encounters Morgan, he turns his back to Morgan. So why wouldn't he, in the third encounter, when Morgan pulls a gun, do the same exact thing? And he did just that. He turned his back. Morgan shot him in the back. And they tried to make it up in the court case, like, oh, well, he was wearing this, you know, medicine bag that had these tiny glass beads in it. And that 9mm hit a glass bead. And that's why it shroomed out. But then, you know, the bullets miraculously, kind of like the JFK assassination, that bullet that goes all the way around that car, the bullet shrinks down and goes back out of his body in one hole. I don't know too many ballistics experts that could actually, you know, quantify how that would happen with physics. But, you know, it does mean that what we have here is a case of injustice. And what I really didn't know going into the book was that you know, Hank Adams out of Washington would call for a march on Washington due to Richard Oakes' death. And a lot of times, you know, the Trail of Broken Trees is not linked to the West Coast movement or to Alcatraz or to Richard, but it in fact has everything to do with Richard and his assassination. And this call for a march on Washington leads it to the takeover of the BIA building in 1972.
So, To close out on this incredibly fascinating story, you know, I think once in the past I was talking to you about this, and I think you, if I remember correctly, compared Oakes to Fred Hampton. and you know, Hampton's assassination. And I guess, you know, Hampton is seen as a sort of iconic figure of the 60s liberation movements. And Oakes, you know, maybe he very well should be. And so I'm wondering, I guess, to kind of build on that comparison, how is it that, I guess first, how is Oakes influential in the development of the Native rights movement over the last now half a century? Like, what is his longer term implications given his early assassination? And then for us who are thinking about these things in the public sphere, how should Oakes' story help us rethink what we say about the 1960s and 1970s?
Oh, that's wonderful. No, I guess one of the fascinating ideas is that issue of coalition politic. And one of the things that I was looking at was that, you know, typically 60s historians will look at San Francisco and they'll try to dissect it apart into little pies or wedges that have no connection. So, you know, I would pick up a book on the Black Panther Party and try to look for anything on Alcatraz or anything that was connected to the Native movement. And there wouldn't be. Right. It was just, you know, this was just a movement about Black power. Black power it has to be segregated intellectually in how we think about it. And that intellectual segregation applied to not just the Black Panther Party, but it also applied to the Brown Berets. And I was like, in my research on the ground is no. I mean, Indians of all tribes was marching in the moratorium marches for, you know, the Brown Berets in East L.A. when everything erupted in violence. They were working with the Black Panther Party, and the Black Panther Party was being inspired by the breakfast program sponsored by the Oakland Indian Friendship House. People like Bobby Seale and Huey Newton were reading Native histories and really identifying in the sense of that third world liberation with this kind of renewed indigeneity and this call to African roots and a connection to those liberation movements and decolonization movements of Africa. So there's all these really strong ties, and I really wanted to write a book that, you know, was more true to that 60s history in the sense of an analysis that brought all these, you know, disparate units or this segregated intellectualism. We had to desegregate our minds. We had to decolonize it a bit. And Richard does that in an academic sense as well. Now, for movements and in his pivotal role in these movements, we can see it in the modern day. I mean, we can see it in Standing Rock. We can see it in Idle No More. I mean, when we think about the violence that he was met with in just this really provocative idea that we as Native peoples have political rights that are separate from other Americans in regards to having sovereignty with our nations, being treated nations. Yeah, no, I mean, we end the book with the violence that takes Richard's life and a violence that we begin to see erupting at Wounded Knee in 1973, in which, you know, armored patrol carriers and equipment that's being used in Vietnam is called out to a place, you know, which served as a massacre in 1890 for, you know, hundreds of Lakota men, women, and children that were butchered by, you know, the 7th Cavalry. So, you know, what we begin to see here is that violence is triggered again. I mean, anytime Indigenous people stand up for our rights, because we have this treaty status, which is in kind of some people view it as an assault or some people view as a threat to democracy of having a nation within a nation, especially on a world court. You know, what rights do Indigenous peoples have when there's 400 million Indigenous peoples around the world? And Native peoples represent kind of a vanguard in this idea of what does it mean to have extra political rights, especially in a you know, kind of a first world nation like the United States, and a nation that tries to pride itself on having this incredible international record on human rights. When people begin to dig down deep and look at that history, especially Indigenous history, it just doesn't hold water. And I think that's, you know, what Indigenous rights movements and activism really brings up in this country. And people begin to get very nervous about it, but they begin to react in various violent manners in the sense of squashing those movements. And Standing Rock, we can see that response has not ended. That in many ways, you know, what Richard Oakes was doing serves as an example for even today in regards to, you know, why is it that we need to stand up? But more importantly, what is it that we need to draw attention to? And I think what we need to draw attention to is the reactions to just trying to claim what is our basic human rights and civil liberties as Native peoples. It's that question that I kind of leave as the title of the book, you know, which, you know, we can't really know freedom unless we kind of think about freedom through the lens of Indigenous history, because essentially not all of us are free. That's a good place to start, right, in these conversations. And oftentimes with my students, even to this day, I'll poll them at the beginning of class before I talk about my research. I'll say, how many of you ever heard about Richard Oakes? And nobody raises their hands, unless they've had a class with me before and they're not allowed to do that. So, but, you know, nobody raises their hands. I do it with audiences in the public. Nobody raises their hand. And I say, you know, it's fascinating to me because by the time I end the talk, people are like really angry. Like, why don't I know this individual? Why was I not taught in K through 12 about Alcatraz, let alone Richard Oakes? I mean, we're taught, you know, about Martin Luther King and the I Have a Dream speech. Well, this was our I Have a Dream. And it's been excluded from history. And there's reasons for that exclusion. And out of that, I think it usually makes people pretty angry when they realize that. And I have to say to them at the end of these talks, you know, what would happen if you didn't know the name Martin Luther King? What would happen if you didn't know the name Dolores Huerta or didn't know the name Cesar Chavez? Where would we be as a country, you know, without those names, without John Lewis? And the problem is that we don't know the names of Native leadership in the same ways. And they're missing. Because this presents a really ideological challenge to the foundation and the fabric of America.
Well, on that very powerful note, we will close today. We've been here with Kent Blancett from the University of Kansas. And his 2018 book, A Journey to Freedom, Richard Oakes, Alcatraz, and the Red Power Movement, is definitely a book that you should all buy. Thank you very much, Kent.
Thanks for having me, Eric.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,